They're going to choose us to man the first interstellar mission, and we'll just end up crashing in the
We'll be like the Guardians of the Galaxy.
West. With no particular skills.
Hey there. Oh,
Oh,
shoot.
there you go. Oh, now we can hear you.
Yeah, I had to figure out how to set up the audio.
Oh, yes.
A miracle. Yay!
Are you relaxing in your study? Where are you?
I'm in the bedroom down at Newtown Square.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Got it.
Yep. Just got back from work.
There we go.
Dan Hunter looking kind of like Alan Watts.
Hey, can you guys start over?
I'll be right back.
Yeah, we're going to start over. The theme for this evening's conversation is waiting for swollen and out of favor to come back.
Swollen
With
and
all these, with all of these young and attractive diva enlightenment people on the circuit, those of us that are long out to pasture, swollen and out of favor, have to kind of wait our turn to see if we can make a comeback.
I am a little long in the tooth.
That's good. I'm sweet in the tooth.
We So someone must have thought of a new theme between a minute ago and now.
I have to say, it's sort of a It's an interesting line to walk when someone has lost a loved one.
Oh, has someone lost a loved one?
Yeah. And what did I say? I said one of my favorite teachers, and I was referring actually to Byron Katie, says, if you really look at it, there is no difference between someone that's and I said passed away, but in this forum I'd say dead, and them being in the next room. Or just out of the room. What the hell's the difference? The only difference is what's in your head.
Oh my. Devastatingly true.
Funerals are like an amazing fest of group agreement that something that may not even be real is true. Something very disturbing. Usually I just kind of don't do funerals. It's never been my
Oh,
favorite.
you don't do funerals except for your own, of course.
If I'm lucky.
I'm not doing mine.
You're not. You're out of there.
I'm not.
We'll come to it and send a postcard.
But it
Did
sounds
someone
like
have
if you want to get everybody on board with a group consensus of a certain reality that's really kind of questionable, go
Oh
with the
yeah.
dead people.
Yeah, right. Did this so you shared this brazen insight with someone that had lost a loved one? How did they respond to it?
Don't think she really got it. She was just, I don't think it sunk in. And I sure
Well,
didn't push, so.
well, I mean that it's I mean it's both true. I mean I on a I mean I have I certainly have one foot in the human world, and it's very sad sometimes. And it's very moving. We have my wife's mom passed away in August. She's a sort of a liberal peacenik college professor, but had been in the Navy with her husband in World War II, and they had a military funeral at Veterans Cemetery in L.A., and it was probably one of the most human and moving rituals I've ever been to. I was shocked. So, yeah, it's, you know, if they're not in the room with you, it is a fantasy if they're not right with you. Mm-hmm. But it's also, you know, you can't deny memory. Even if it is a fantasy, it's still memory.
But I would contend that all the consternation and the pain is pretty much generated just from mind stuff.
Maybe. I mean, there's a lot to be said for biological resonance that you have with an atmosphere, as in a home, a room, an automobile, an animal, favorite clothing. And certainly, you know, if you've spent many years with a partner or have a certain kind of, close affection and contact with, you know, parents or siblings, certainly offspring. So there's a lot more to the beauty and the unbearable nature of grief than mind stuff alone. I mean, as you know, as biologic creatures, to the extent that we could be held responsible for that, there's all kinds of stuff that's going on that dictates our behavior, our social strategies, right? Societal strategies and agreements, the kinds of dwellings that we live in, right? There's all kinds of stuff that influences how humans hang out with humans, whether in more, you know, primitive tropical areas or in places of extreme, if not lethal, weather. So life and death, togetherness, memory, biologic resonance, aroma, right, pheromonal loyalty, not just emotional loyalty, pheromonal loyalty, is profound and plays a part in how we hang out, how we live with each other, and how we suffer when someone survives someone's loss.
I mean, everything's immediately going away or arriving. Yeah. And some of it's poignant, and maybe all of it's poignant. I'm not sure. But I think unless I had Alzheimer's, I think it'd be a little bit of a lie to say that it didn't mean something when someone leaves. You know. Although, you know, my kid's away at college right now. He might as well be dead. I mean, I don't know. It's just a fantasy that he's around. And the knowledge that he's, you know, the fantasy that I think he's still around is comforting when I think about it, and it's out of mind when I don't think about it. But at the same time, I don't have Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Not yet, or at least we haven't told you yet.
That's why I come to these meetings, to get the bad news.
Really? How am I doing? Tell me if I'm slipping. Well, I mean, let's play around with the shock that occurs. Maybe we've felt it in our own lives to some smaller or greater degree. Maybe we haven't yet been exposed to it. But that kind of shock that occurs when someone survives someone else's passing. You know, whether suddenly or through a period of, you know, protracted and, you know, protracted illness. Really. I mean, the whole frame of reality that keeps us kind of asleep through our lives gets thrown into an absolute tizzy when, you know, a significant event occurs. It could be injury, accident, or, you know, death, whether a slow one or a sudden one, whether for a senior citizen or, you know, a young person. It really rattles us, the loss of a human being that we've known and or known well or lived with. It really rattles us deeply. Why shouldn't it? I mean, we're not aiming for, you know, immunity from the beauty of living.
Yeah.
That'd be stupid, at a minimum.
Well, but then you're just kind of back in that game, you know? It's like the other day I was like, oh, I wish my mom would stop worrying about me. It's like, that's the dumbest statement. She's a mother. You know what I mean? Like,
biological.
And if I, me not wanting, you know, wishing she would worry less is like ridiculous demand to place or whatever, you know, but.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting is the fragility of our, call it default consciousness, right? You know, we've bathed, we've put on clothing, we've gone through the day, maybe we've fed ourselves, we've hopefully eliminated satisfactorily once or twice. So we're on a roll. And sometimes we feel good and sometimes not. Maybe we're aiming for peak experience. Maybe we don't give a fuck anymore. But there's a certain kind of default, call it quality, of our, you know, ordinary consciousness. And we don't really notice it so much. I mean, it's that kind of, you know, fish in the water metaphor. We don't really take much notice of our default consciousness and how we move through a day. But when a major event, a disturbing event occurs, injury or loss or death, or, you know, shit, someone's house burns down that they grew up in, you know, without even any loss of life, those are, you know, profound shocks to the default consciousness.
Yep.
And we could say, you know, if we were to be kind of haughty New Agers, that this level, profound level of uncertainty, incredulity, non-reliability is present all the time, right? We just habituate to the miracle of living, the chaotic, mad, wonderful, bizarre, enthralling miracle of living. We habituate to it, and that becomes the default consciousness. We wouldn't even know how to live if some spiritual master came down the street and said, well, you should practice living as if your house just burned down. You should practice living as if, you know, you just lost your dog of 10 years. Right? We wouldn't even know what to do with that advice. We're so, you know, kind of organically comfortable with the rhythm of who we are, how we experience ourselves.
What cracks me up is how the individual pretends it's such a surprise when continuity is lost in some of those ways. It's like, oh my God, how could this happen? And especially, like, how could this happen to me?
Oh, yes, of course.
You know, it's kind of what you sign up to when you arrive here. It's like, you better sign on the line of this is completely unpredictable and shit happens. It's just how it goes.
That's right. And you know, I mean, unless you're kind of a mad and or aspiring yogi thinking that you're heading for the cliff of nirvana, most people, you know, don't really think about the nature and quality of their default consciousness, right? They're not that, whatever that weird switch is that turns you into someone that's really, really curious about the nature of reality, perhaps the nature of transcendence, the possibility of self-realization as if it were something real and could be we could entertain ourselves with it. So very few people even appreciate that there's anything other than the default consciousness that they're wearing or living day to day. We're kind of sitting ducks for discontinuity.
and also, but the thing is, even if you aren't a sitting duck for discontinuity, that's not saying that everything isn't a surprise. And I think to deny that things are, when someone dies, it's pretty fucking incomprehensible. I mean, I don't think anyone can wrap their mind around it. I mean, fuck, you know, you can't.
No.
I don't care how enlightened you are. It's a surprise. And if it's not a surprise, I think that's another daydream.
I'm down with that. I like that sentiment. Sounds real to me. Not that it matters, but yeah, I hear you.
That was surprising. No, I was kidding.
I've been to, I think it was one of the schools for the work that I went to. There was a girl there, and she had a sister that was a climber, went up on a mountaintop, like major mountain climbing stuff in the wintertime or something, and died up there.
Wow.
And I watched this woman through the work and hanging out with Byron Katie switch from utterly devastated, tearful, big issue to laughingly joking, my sister's a popsicle. I don't know what the problem is. It's like, like you want to talk about a change in continuity of thought?
Uh-huh.
What I witnessed through my own experience and through seeing others, this example is what I gave, a huge change in continuity of how we see the world, just in, I guess, questioning that there's really a problem there.
Yeah.
I feel like you'll see the same response almost too, if you just by questioning people, getting them to question some things or whatever, making a statement or anything that, you know, completely jars them out of their normal way of thinking, they respond in the same sort of bizarre surprise. They do all kinds of weird shit. Because they can't, it's like so disturbing, you know.
This is disturbing. Yeah, I mean, I think to have the gift of being able to play around with and look at the nature of the texture of consciousness and, you know, really tease it out is thrilling and disturbing. I mean, for me, it's you know, being kind of an addict for altered states for as long as I can remember. I like it.
I like it too. I'm saying people that aren't interested, you know, they respond the same way that someone might respond to death in a sense, you know? It's like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Who are you to question my whatever continuity, my, you know?
It is kind of amazing.
Yeah, no, don't entertain it. Yeah, people become violent and violated if, you know, their sense of continuity is disturbed or challenged, you know, by a question or an inquiry or an event that they hadn't hoped for.
Or sometimes they're surprisingly open to it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, the human popsicle is a good example of that.
Ah.
But it's also, you know, it's always hypothetical until it happens, you know. Some things don't, you know, some things that would have just, you know, derailed me, you know, years ago are like, roll off my back and I go, how'd that happen? You know, just, you know, it's like, I'm not sure if it's something that you can design. As a matter of fact, I know you can't design it. I think it's, you know, the Byron Katie example is, um, how would I say it, great good luck that there was guidance there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's neat. I mean, to be in the company of, you know, a very profound awakener like Byron Katie, who just has a really a profound gift for getting under the hood of reality and turning it into a bliss fest. Yeah, you'd be really lucky to have her on your team if you were just had gone through, you know, the grief of loss.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's probably too busy to do grief counseling, but of course she's a natural for it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, like I could think, you know, I have a confession here. I'm horribly in love with my dog, my little dog.
Yeah. And, yeah, we knew that, but thanks for the confession.
Is he there? Can you show him to us?
He's actually on a walk right now.
Well, when he comes back, pull him on.
His favorite time of the day. Oh, when I take him off the screen, you might start crying.
It's bad.
It's bad.
People all over the neighborhood weep as he walks out of view.
Thank you. Finally, somebody recognizes the. Anyway.
I get it.
You know what? I have no idea how I'll be when he. I know he'll most likely have a shorter life than I do. But I mean, one can hope. It's like the Tibetan blessing: may your dog die, may you die, may your. And you know, maybe it'll happen. I go, I've already grieved over this. No problem. Or it might be like, oh my God, my, you know.
Yeah.
Someone shoot me.
Isn't every moment, you know, a hypothetical?
Yeah.
I mean, anything thought or felt or construed that we think we're convinced of is kind of ongoing hypothetical. That's why we mentioned earlier today a default consciousness that we've absolutely become habituated to. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing that how you cannot see that it's not, that there's no way you can, you don't have any idea what's going to happen.
No.
Going to look or.
Yeah.
I think I asked Peter once, you know, well, is this a good thing to do to kind of practice, you know, when bigger things come up? And he said, I'm thinking about putting myself in a certain situation to see if I can handle it now. And he goes, that's not the way you do it. It's just, you know, you just relate to what's going on now. The big stuff will take care of itself. You know, it's like, you don't have to put yourself in either in the trying situations or try to bring about hypothetical things or thinking, I wonder how I'm going to handle this one. You know, it's just, you just stay as current as
you don't have to kill your dog and see how you feel.
How dare you?
Oh my goodness.
Exactly. Listen, oh, here we go.
Blasphemy.
Now we're slinging it.
It's a rough bunch.
This is a rough crowd, I know.
And it's only because I love my dog as much, so that's...
It's my dog is the best dog in the world.
Well, I have a dog
okay.
off.
A dog off.
I'll bring one of my cats up.
Oh, cats are right.
You know, I'll sit around and talk to our animals like giant babies. You're so cute.
Hey, I came up with a great nickname for my dog. Sir Fur. Surfer.
I like it.
I like it too.
A little hot dog surf? Or no?
Sir what? I'm sorry?
Does the little dog surf?
He does not. But he surfs his own energy really well. And he's really great at mealtimes. He shines.
Hey.
Sorry, I got off the track there.
Hardly. We're just having a few moments of canine affection. That's all good.
It's rare that I'm worried about my dog's place in the herd rather than my place in the herd. You know, I think it's a positive step forward.
Well, you know, you don't know. Your dog could have been a former Dzogchen master who you served, or it could have been the other way around, and now you're enjoying serving him this lifetime.
I think you're right, probably.
Yeah. Some of these deep affections seem to show up again and again over millennia, over yugas.
I wonder what the Dzogchen master did to deserve fleas.
Yeah, mine too.
He's still giving us a hard time.
No. This, you know, the sense of invulnerability. Francine's screen is going wacko again.
My screen is?
The sense of, what the hell do we want from this? You know, why might we be interested in yogic understanding or something promised by the sages? What's in it for us? I mean, truly, are we looking for emotional invulnerability, omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotency, right? Controlling the course of the universe. What the fuck do we want?
You know what's funny? I used to think it was really going to give me something. And hanging out with you, Jeff, I got a good sized dose of, it's not going to give me anything, and just give it up.
Well, that's just because I'm a swollen poser. That's all I can. It's all I can convey.
You absolutely make sense. I mean, it just, I get that what you talk about in terms of this isn't going to save you from anything, and it's not for the I. What really cracks me up is that it's getting bigger and, like, more present in my life, and yet I expect less of it.
Yeah.
I used to be riding this bike to get somewhere. I was sure I was going to get somewhere, and if I just rode long enough and hard enough, I'd get there.
It's an inverse relationship, right? The quieter you become, let's say, inwardly, the more naturally relaxed and available or effervescent that we become through just profound relaxation, then it makes sense that the expressive plenum of experiencing would have a chance to show more of itself to us. Place fewer demands on an infinity, and what do you think it's going to do?
I feel like it's just that boundary that you put up. I mean, this is total bullshit, but, you know, when I have the boundary, I think I'm little. But it's not true. That's never true. It's just, like, the idea, framework, whatever. And that, even though it's not a process, that does seem to be expanding in some way.
Yeah, we don't.
It's just going to infinity. You know, it's just bizarre.
Yeah, we don't. No one's gotten, you know, close enough to the sun, or even from a distance of roughly 93 million miles, and said, "Yo, how's it going out there? How you feeling? Are you, like, loving your consciousness up there, or what?" You know, nobody knows. The sun could be having an experience, whatever that means, of such unadulterated, radiant, you know, self-immolating delight that a mere fraction of it would turn us to a crisp in an instant. We don't really know how much bliss the sun is enjoying, or the moon on a full moon lit night. you know, when it's saturated in sunlight. We don't know how Venus is feeling lately, or, you know, somebody's moons, as in celestial bodies.
Oh, okay. Okay, good.
Where'd Jeff go?
We lost him.
I think he's getting ready. I think he's getting ready to moon us.
That's what metaphor does to you. Just wait.
Is that where you're heading with this? You want to moon us?
Is when you start talking about the moon.
Yeah, yeah. I was just saying, yeah, for a good moon.
I got a good one for you.
Hey, let's make these teachings real. I mean, what does conscious mean? Consciousness mean? Why do we presume that it should look or feel a certain way, you know, through the primate prism? I mean, if what's happening in the middle of a far distant galaxy, whatever it might be that's happening there, right, molecularly, photonically, or even perhaps biologically, isn't it the same bizarritude that's happening as in right here, right now, right this? I mean, are there countless dimensions in which phenomena expresses itself, or can it just look any way that it looks, but it's made of the same stuff or the same impulse, the same affection, no matter where it may be occurring? You know, we don't know. It's kind of strange. It's almost like you have to take it on faith in a manner of speaking to feel that the profundity that you are or that this is right now is pretty much what this is everywhere.
All we really have is our own experience. That's it.
Yeah.
The only data point we really have is what we experience. Everything else is just pure conjecture.
Yes.
From someone being dead to how the sun feels beaming down at us.
Yes. We're not living according to preparation, you know, or choice. Maybe not even destiny. Maybe the whole notion of free will as contrasted with manifest destiny is just inaccurate completely.
I have no
idea.
You
mean it's neither?
Huh?
That you mean it's neither?
Yeah. Yeah, that it's neither. That manifest destiny, meaning that you're fated in a way, as contrasted with operating presently through the lens of free will. Both of those are just kind of superficial heresies. Neither one is real, and so there's no real battle between them.
It's like trying to define and put a thing on something so magical, it's retarded. It's like, why would you? It's totally magical. Like, no, seriously,
right.
You can do whatever, anything.
No, that's actually a great way to put it. That there's a Benjamin Lee Whorf wrote about the Hopi Indian language, and they don't have a name for a river because it's changing all the time. I mean, they don't put containers on things that are containerless, you know. Which I think is really cool. I mean, it's a poetic way to say what you were just saying. Which is really cool.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm not very poetic.
No, it's very poetic what you said. Probably more poetic than me quoting somebody else.
Gets more and more poetic every time I take a... Wow.
I get less poetic.
I can quote Peter again. He said that we are like the sun shining out of the void.
Nice.
Or we are the sun shining out of the void.
Shining in the void.
Shining in the void, yeah. Blasting.
Doesn't always feel like that. Sometimes it feels kind of just boring, sleepy, dead.
That's what the sun feels like.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Well, you know, it's interesting what happens to one's present sensitivity. If the the hallucination of time or meaning or anticipation just starts to drift out of the default consciousness. You know, we don't have a liturgy or an idea of life needing to be a certain way, or of one's enlightenment being accelerated, you know, through the clever terminology of Bentinho Massaro. Right? we don't have to place any pressure on ourselves for doing the right thing, not doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Bringing the best, most optimal demand upon consciousness necessary so that we're making the best use of this vital lifetime. Fuck that. You know, fuck you, fuck me, fuck this. Who gives a shit?
No one.
That's a great book title. Fuck you, fuck
me. Yeah, it has a ring to it.
There's something that sort of takes the pressure off when you get you're not that important. It's not that important. Your enjoyment, your struggles, your anything is just not.
Well, I think what happens is, yes, I would say that a profundity, which is what's already present, has a chance to sing in the shower when everything that clutters it up, like my importance, my demands, right, my takeaway, my insistences, just become quiet or non-demanding, then the miraculous, you know, chaotic beauty of whatever this is or isn't has a little more wiggle room to reveal itself to itself, because we're not insisting on, you know, the human dramatoid. So fuck it up.
Well, you just start paying attention. Who knows how that happens? But it's like all of a sudden you're like, oh,
yeah.
There's other stuff here.
You know, the point of kind of or come at it from another direction than in terms of self-importance. I think this may be saying the same thing and probably even more cliched, but that. I'm continually, or I'm often surprised that the whole thing, that what I've always been looking for is already, you know, right here. I've just been overlooking it and thinking it's something else. And you know, thinking it's more elevated or more different, like it's a different kind of awareness or a different kind of awake or a different kind of, you know, and it's really not. And then when I just start appreciating just the normal shit, it's not shit anymore. And I just have to learn it over and over. And that's the practice part, is over and over and over again, is like, oh, this is really cool. It's really not somewhere else.
Well, I think if, you know, we're breaking out of that shell of habituation to default consciousness. Because, oh my goodness, whatever this is or isn't is clearly, if not irrefutably present, whatever that means. And if I'm not being bogged down in justifications, explanations, and the pursuit of security or entertainment, then it's possible, call it cellularly, photonically, spiritually, rainbow body, you know, whatever the fuck metaphor you like, this a light unto itself. And even though we may be blue collar and mundane, we can feel it. This doesn't hold us in the same, what would you call it, ill repute that we hold ourselves. It's not nearly as condemning of us as we are toward ourselves.
That's a nice way
to say it. Thank God.
Yeah, really. Thank God Jesus loves me because I'm doing a bad job.
Lord, I want to be in this number.
Well, every idea we have about ourselves or the world is really a barrier to it.
Yes, it's an expressive, you know, misrepresentation of what this may actually be. Because this is not an idea, though ideas appear in it. Right? This is not actually a permutation, though permutation appears in it. That's a very profound challenge, is to invite a fellow human being with or without earned intimacy or trust to shake them out of it. I mean, I was reflecting on, I was talking with Beth this morning and reflecting on our meeting last Friday with our dear yoga friend, Tom. Came to visit us at Panera. And, I mean, I realize that I kind of take profound liberties meeting a new person by inviting them into an intimacy that we haven't even earned yet. You know, it's like, I'm not saying, hey, how you doing? Let's get to know each other for a few months, a few years, a few lifetimes. I'm just going to go right for your face and say, so how do you feel about enlightenment, like, right now? How do you feel about waking up right now? How do you feel about the fact that you're God right now? I mean, you mind sharing that with me? I mean, you've only met... you've only just met me, but how's it going?
What? No, and
that's freaky.
Well, it's even more, it's funny to look back at our bizarre little group and be like, I have no idea, I sat down with dinner with Lisa the other day and it was kind of normal people, whatever. I'm like, I don't really know anything about anybody in our group. Like as a person, two years,
Yeah. Yeah, nobody really cares.
No,
it's nice not to pretend.
But you've softened, though. You've softened since I first saw you going. I mean, I first saw you in L.A. at Peter's thing, like 2007, and you softened since then a lot. I mean, you used to be Mr. Ambush. Maybe you still are. But...
Yeah, oh. Dan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still know.
I think it was just specially designed for me.
Everything is
perfect.
Everything is.
Well, it's curious to look at these kinds of two aspects of intimacy. You know, one is the kind of getting to know a person, getting to know their story, being invited into their petty miseries, you know, being a someone they might confide in. And you're like, cats. And then there's the other intimacy, which is like, oh, my God, this is awake. And we can explore it together without even going through the pleasantries or unpleasantries of getting to know each other's story.
Yeah.
There's
and that is, it is odd. It's a little bit shocking.
It's just so much bigger than our little stories. What we're pointing to, what we come together to touch on, is just so much more satisfying and I guess a bigger field of view than our little stories.
Yeah,
it provides
really
more commonality. What's that?
I enjoy the whole backward nature of it. It's like, you know, you know somebody for a few years as this person who is whose light bulb was getting turned on by this stuff, and then later on you go, oh, you work at Starbucks. Oh, okay. I really enjoy that. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it's the inverse of what normally happens.
Yeah. Well, it's great. Yeah. But, you know, there's permission, too, because people have come there for that. So it is easy. It's easy because of that. I am not, I know that, Jeff, you've had experience with that. I am not experiencing going up there, you know, like total strangers and going, what the fuck are you thinking?
Well, it's an unusual kind of intimacy that I think is, you know, to make social commentary kind of lacking within the social structure, within the tribal structure, because the, you know, the one-tenth of the 1% have been so completely successful at fracturizing us, right? A chicken in every pot and a car in every garage, right? So a certain kind of tribal intensity which lifts us up spiritually is bereft of our lives, you know, living inside our own wooden and concrete domicile and commuting more or less alone. And so getting together, you know, whether it's to make music or perform, you know, in a theater presentation, or to do self-realization inquiry, is kind of profound. It's very nourishing. It uplifts a certain kind of human dignity which is missing from the culture at large.
Well, we're not, like, eyeing each other up about our circumstances and events, which is, you know, exhausting and whatever can be.
And it bypasses also, besides the gestation in life, but it also bypasses the sort of like major psychological patterns of inferiority or superiority and all that kind of stuff.
It absolutely can. Yeah. You know, if in order to do this kind of intimacy, to look at the nature of consciousness and stand up, you know, in it, feel it, dig it, stalk it, you have to have some kind of practical healing from clinical codependency. There has to be some kind of courage available in one's heart to look at things this way without the, you know, that chronic dissatisfaction of victimization or neediness or isolation. And I mean, so, you know, so much suffering in the social milieu has to do with clinical codependence and suffering from, you know, deep confusion.
I think we're really lucky. Even in this fuse meeting, but also with Peter, that things are at a small enough level that there's no, I mean, you really can't hide out too much.
Right.
Yeah, it's not this thing where you're sitting in the big auditorium being entertained by somebody who, you know, stares at you in the eye and makes you feel blissed out. I mean, it's a whole different number.
Yeah.
Because
go ahead.
Well, I'm saying it's very easy to kind of run your codependency shit in that kind of a larger situation. It doesn't come to the fore. Doesn't have to.
Yeah, well, you know, once you start negotiating with seekers as a accomplished teacher with cameras, chairs, microphones, and all of those trappings, then you're asking for it. You're just asking for it. You know, you're gonna get the indulgent lamentation of people that are confused. And spirituality is not the remedy for them. Which is weird, you know, because a lot of us have turned to spirituality as the remedy for psycho-emotional, right, confusion, psycho-emotional neediness. 12-step meeting is a better place for that kind of humor.
Yeah. The closest Peter gets to that, he said it in one email, which I really loved. You know, he always says, you know, what else is going on or look elsewhere. But he says, like a bullfighter, you know, you don't sit there and, you know, put your cape on and say, oh, come on, get me. You know, it's like you put the cape on and you sidestep him. It's like, stop working on this shit. Just sidestep it.
Yeah. That's a very curious maturity, isn't it?
Yeah.
We can't really point to those moments, cathartic or while we were sleeping, where a certain kind of healing occurred and we were given permission to, you know, move on with our inquiry. It's too strange how healing from codependency actually occurs.
I don't know. I know when I caught. I remember. What was that book? That guy that came out with a book about codependency. One of the first guys. God, I can't remember now. But anyway, I read the book and I was like, oh my God. It's like, you know, whatever you focus on expands. And man, that's like, oh, you know, no way out of here.
Yeah, really. There's no way out of this.
And basically, it was just it was just focus. The whole problem was focus. John, somebody.
Yes, John, that's right. I went to one of his lectures in the Valley, I think.
Were you in L.A. at the time?
Yeah. John, what's his name? Why have we forgotten his name? He was one of the biggest gurus on the scene in that field, right?
Yeah. You know what?
Oh, well.
That's what
comes and goes.
I'll get back to you here.
Like, maybe it was John Vivekananda. Nah, that wasn't it. I remember he was giving a talk at a hotel in, one of those hotels in the Valley, the San Fernando Valley, where there is no longer any codependence. And he got hijacked by a local reporter with a camera, you know, a bright TV camera. He was hijacked, literally coming out of the elevator from his room, and asked all these really sensitive questions about some business dealings and sex addiction and accusations being made by an Australian business partner that was probably like tearing up his reputation. And, I mean, he was in shock. He was just in shock. He had no idea what he was about to step into. And he tried to answer everything as professionally as he could. And then you could see that he had just gotten way too flustered for comfort and excused himself. Oh, look who it is. The ghostly galleon.
Ghostly. Beth!
Hey! Can you hear me?
Yeah. We can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh,
yes. You're very purple. That's a spiritual color.
I am. It's just beaming out of my head.
Awesome.
Continue, John Bradshaw.
John
Bradshaw.
Thank you. Wow.
That's what we were waiting for.
It's pretty healing at the beginning when he started that stuff because no one had expressed it quite that, you know.
He was brilliant. He truly was brilliant. He was on PBS, right?
I don't remember.
I think that's how he became popular. He was doing, you know, inner child and family structures programming on PBS.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff was just kind of coming out.
Yeah. That's back when we realized, God, not only am I really fucked up in this area, I'm really fucked up in this area. I'm codependent. I've got, you know, it's like, I need to join 12 12-step groups.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not a day in the week that I shouldn't be at a meeting.
They shouldn't let me out. They should lock me in and... I've got dog...
Nah, they just gave you Zog Chen.
Dog Chen. Wow.
The good old days.
It's funny because it feels... I mean, with us talking in this context, it feels more... it's sort of bringing something up to the light of day, which is very refreshing.
Hmm. Yeah.
Oh, it's coming. It's nice.
There's a kind of discontinuity, I guess you could call it, in that, you know, who we were in the past or how we processed consciousness in the past. Well, I don't know. It can feel like there's a kind of a profound chasm between how I processed or experienced my own life in the past and the weird way that, you know, it appears to me now. I couldn't even draw, you know, a line between the two.
I don't know if it was like this for you. I just feel like I was just one big fat problem after another.
Yep. 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 We can all agree, not about you, but about ourselves.
Yeah, well, I don't feel like I ever actually processed anything.
Interesting.
It was just dwelling on problems, whereas now they just tend more to disappear.
That's funny. I mean, yeah, it's really interesting to see that all the effort that we may have given to resolve things didn't have any utility ever anyway.
None whatsoever.
Yeah, and it was just the nature of the hallucination that kept things rolling along.
Boy.
Well, it was part of the default consciousness. I like that word.
Yes, it is. I mean, in what we would call Western society, or at least, you know, the bizarre way it shows up in these United States, it's a kind of a curious default consciousness. I don't know enough, you know, Europeans or Africans or South Americans or Canadians even to have any confidence about asking them, well, what's your default consciousness?
Oh man, I think they've got the New Age stuff really bad. At least some of the Europeans. I think when I see stuff on the tube, I go, "Whoa!"
Yeah,
that feels like me back in the '90s, which used to be pretty avant-garde.
Yeah, that's right.
In
some respects, the European culture is a lot more mature than we are, and in other respects, it hasn't caught up to us yet.
Yeah. Man, I used to grovel a lot. I mean, teaching stuff, you know. Ugh. I need an aspirin.
Yeah, once you start thinking about how we were, the way we were, we need an aspirin and a Barbara Streisand tune.
Like kind of some serious, like a Xanax or what's the thing that you take if you get anxious before you go to the dentist?
What is that?
No.
Acid?
Acid. That's what we need.
That's what I prefer, but yeah.
If we keep reminiscing about our chronic codependency, we're going to need to take acid.
Well, if you try to like think about how you used to be or what, you know, if it drops in on your personality, kind of drops in on some level, like what you would normally be doing at this hour, whatever, you know, it can be very shocking when you're like, that's not what's going on. Like what happened?
I feel like I just took a great dump. I don't know about you guys, but
Oh, good. I love when the conversation goes scatological.
Speaking of which, I have someone to show you.
Where's my dog?
Oh, the dog must be back from his walk.
I thought he was going to say, "Where's my wife?"
No, I did that earlier.
Suzanne, how was your day?
Surf her.
Nice.
We can't hear you. I don't think your microphone's on. There he
is.
Cute. Isn't that the dog putting a hot dog bun in that email once?
Hey.
How curious how you look alike.
I'm codependent. Come on, Brad. Look at me.
Nah, you're just in love with your dog.
Okay, thank you. I had my fix.
Thank you. No, that was. I feel much better now.
I feel better about my codependent relationship with my dog now.
Very good. Always here to serve.
Fantastic. Well. Anyone in the peanut gallery that hasn't said anything? Hi, Kev.
Stand by. Technical difficulties.
That's my IT guy.
Now we can hear you.
Yeah, I have my IT guy. Oh. You guys all sound so enlightened, and I'm just driving home a bitter kitten, you know, so.
We'll do anything to make somebody feel small.
Yeah.
Was it the scatological comments that made it seem enlightened, or what? I'm not quite sure.
I think that, definitely. Definitely.
Huh. I'll have to use that more often.
Yeah, all you have to do is say John Bradshaw and people think like you're cool.
Yeah, I heard some of the John Bradshaw stuff. I don't know how I feel. I never read any of his books or anything.
Wow, really? You escaped that?
Healing the Shame That Binds You, all that stuff. I was very
bitter kittenish.
Anti-disease model at one time. Now I'm a little more flexible in my thinking, but
good for you.
Now you're ready for it.
No, I just had some professor in grad school and who really didn't like the disease model, and so then I became very prejudiced towards that kind of vernacular.
Well, lucky you.
I didn't know John Bradshaw's name. I Googled codependent John.
Oh, it came up right away, I bet.
Yep.
Oh yeah, sure. Well, he was the master of healing your inner child.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Transcending toxic shame.
Did anybody have that happen with that?
No, I still have not transcended my toxic shame.
Actually, I got toxic shame from reading the book.
Yeah, I think those kind of books are very shaming, actually. That's my feeling.
They could be.
Reduce
yeah.
shame instead of reduce shame.
I sort of somewhere remember that I was really on board with everything he was doing until I found out that he was a lot sicker than he was letting on to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had a lot more things going on besides than shame, I think. I could be wrong.
Were you listening to the news?
What happened to the guy? He just faded out?
Yeah, I think he faded out.
Is he the guy who wrote Iron John or Fire in the Belly or the Men?
No, that's Robert Bly.
Robert Bly. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to assess what contribution these formidable authors and public speakers have made. to the consciousness overall, or, you know, whether they contributed to some relief from suffering, or whether they were just anecdotal entertainers along the way.
It's a great question. It really is, actually.
Because we see, you know, in the current milieu, Francine, I think your mic is going crazy again, but we have just as many illustrious and respectable soothsayers on the current stage today, right, as we have ever had, maybe more so than before. I mean, Oprah Winfrey's done her fair share of exposing middle America to, you know, all kinds of bright minds. And you wonder, you know, what's come of it? I mean, 6 million people read The Power of Now and The New Earth. And my question is, so? What's come of it? Where do we see the, I don't know, substantive evidence of a shift in consciousness? What would the symptoms be? I mean, the Koch brothers would just give themselves up and place themselves in jail for the rest of their lives? Obama would resign and say, you know, I made a bunch of promises that I did not and could not keep because, you know, they had my grandparents locked up in a cellar somewhere. I'm sorry I failed you. You know, everyone that belongs to ISIS just decides to go home.
What is there to talk about?
That's what we've been sitting here for the last hour and a half trying to figure out.
Well, there's nothing to be said.
Well, we've been talking about...
You can say things, but they have about as much impact as, snail farts.
Yes, that's right. They have as much impact as a snail fart.
Snail fart changed my life.
They can. I mean, if you're following string theory, if a snail farts in Madagascar, a cargo ship could go, you know, roll under, you know, just south of Greenland. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I felt that.
Let's put it this way. We're being exposed to a profoundly grand experiment called life. We don't know how long it's going to run for, at least in our own biological allotment. And we can see the effects in our own consciousness or the people whom we love of the conformist despair that nearly the entire species has signed up for. And who knows, maybe we can actually fight back somehow. I'm not sure what that means.
No. You can have the illusion of that.
Fair enough. Maybe the illusion of it is it's good.
That's all you get.
Yeah, maybe. But even within the, let's say, the context of it being an illusion or illusory, it's not nothing. And we're not, you know, we don't measure it according to, let's call it, human deliverables. Then it could turn out to be quite something. I mean, that's the, you know, that's the bait and switch of the of awakened speak, right? Awake and Speak does have a bait and switch. It's like, yeah, this is fucked. Yeah, we're fucked. Yeah, nothing means anything. And still, you know, what do you do with the potent, incredible creativity that you are? Maybe there's something to do with it. Maybe there's something fun. Maybe there's something, who knows, transcendent, egalitarian, right? Nonviolent.
It's just doing.
Yes. Fair enough.
And lucky if you are, if you find the doing that you that you have the experience of enjoying.
Yes. You can feel this through, you know, unnameable filters of weirdness. And we're creative, we're adventurers, you know, we want to go, we want to be pioneers. And so the way that we practice being pioneers is to explore the nature, the textures of consciousness, of present being, to see what it might have in store for us, see if there's anything to it besides besides the horrific bullshit we're sold by the media, by the educational institution, by our employers.
Our own language.
Yes. That's
trap
right.
Of your own speaking. I have a hunch there may not be anything to say, even though they're speaking.
Well, that's of course, that's always the case. It doesn't mean one is preferable to the other. While there is speaking, there is nothing to say. While there is nothing to say, there's tremendous joy in communicating.
Right.
Right? I mean, they're not mutually exclusive, are they?
This is not based on logic.
Thank God for that. Maybe that's where John Bradshaw went wrong. He was basing his philosophy on logic.
I think John Bradshaw got so codependent, he achieved unity.
Yeah, maybe he became unity. He achieved unity with his own codependent nature.
Well, maybe there's hope. Yeah.
I'm counting on that.
The illusion is that we think we can think this.
I like that, too. Whatever appears in consciousness, in speech, in feeling, in sentimentality, we think we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How lovely a texture to see or feel that this is actually occurring truly of its own accord.
Once in a while, you get it right between the eyes.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think present experience is way more generous than we dare admit with respect to revealing just how deliciously strange this is. But thank God we're not trying to fix anything or seek or offer advice. That's a real relief.
That I would identify as the singular value of these conversations.
Yeah.
Get off your fucking high horse. Really? Give it up.
It's nice. It's fun to be humans together without the pressure of having to seek or offer advice.
Nobody has this figured out. Just cool it.
Yeah.
We're a human being, not a human doing. Isn't that something John Bradshaw said?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm a spiritual being having a human experience, something like that.
Yeah. It just means that don't take either one of those positions. as having triggered
yes.
that.
Yes, why? That's right. Why take a position? I mean, you're molten magma.
Yes, capable of an infinite number of things simultaneously.
Yes.
Contradicting.
You're hot molten magma spewing out of the womb of Mother Earth, putting on a splurge show that is just fantastic. Why take a position?
Mm-hmm. That's a shortcut to being abused.
Yeah, it's really strange to undercut this kind of foundational presumption that consciousness is about something, that life is about something, and that something, you know, can be characterized by human sentiment, human desire,
yeah,
human understanding.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't about anything. and so here we are in the midst of this incredible expressive wonder, with or without primate identification. And this is not about anything. This is like fucking gleeful.
You can actually make money out of allowing other humans to hold that position.
Yeah. Yes, a lot of folks do make money in the strangest of ways. Okay, well, it's 9:00. Who wants? I certainly don't want to keep anyone. Thanks everyone for showing up and making this the marvelous party that it was.
Can we see Stan's dog one more time?
Please show us the dog, Stan.
Oh, okay.
Please show us the dog.
One second. Oh, no, you're...
Yay! Yay, I want to tuck him in.
Oh, what a cutie.
I can move the computer, not the dog. It's amazing. Nilo.
Oh, there we go.
Oh.
Where's Fred?
Oh.
Dan, can we come live with you or at least near you?
Yes.
Thank you.
But it just never, it's my dog.
That's okay. We just want to be near your dog.
Okay. I understand. The small fee involved.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, everyone. I hope I have a chance to see some of you on Thursday later this week.
That's right.
And I think I may be mistaken, but in case you feel like staying up later and eavesdropping on Peter Brown, I think he's broadcasting tonight from the Open Secret Bookstore in San Rafael.
I probably
will go to bed, but who knows.
Is that on YouTube, Jeff?
Yeah, he should be broadcasting tonight on YouTube if he gets his shit together.
Great. Okay.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye,
thank
everybody.
You. Bye. Good night.
Bye. Bye.